Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. Tonight is February 24th, 2017, and I'm Julia Cannon, and I am so excited for our guest tonight. Let's see, my goodness, we have so much coming up. I'm getting ready to leave, and so my mind's kind of in different places, several different places, preparing for classes, as well as our conferences that are coming up, and that's what our guest is all about tonight. We have our UFO conference coming up in April. It'll be the second weekend in April in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, as it's always the second weekend in April in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And so excited. He's one of our keynote speakers, Grant Cameron. My goodness, Grant. I'm going to have you. Tell your story, because that is your journey, is your story. You know, really, is your whole life has been in this, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, I was drag kicking and screaming, though. I mean, I didn't really plan anything. It just sort of happened, and then something else dragged me into another rabbit hole and another rabbit hole. And that's been, as you say, it's been my life since I was about 22 years old, when I basically fell off the edge of the world and never returned. It was like, it just absolutely changed my life. And I've had three very life-altering experiences, and the journey continues.
Well, let's go into that, because, you know, rather than read your, you know, your accolades and all your awards and things like that, I like to go from that perspective. And let's just go back to the beginning of how everything started, and then kind of bring you up through to now, because that's, to me, the exciting thing is your story. You know, how you got into all this and what happened. So let's go back to there. Let's see what happened to got you into all this and got you, you know, dragged you into this.
So. Okay. What happens is I'm 22 years old. I'm at the University of Manitoba. I live in Canada, just north of North Dakota, on the about 60 miles from the border, north of the border. I'm a university student. I have no interest in ufology whatsoever. I can't ever have a thought about extraterrestrials or anything. I was interested in near-death experiences. I was interested in Edgar Cayce. And when I was at university, I had done a paper where I've always been fascinated with death. So what I'd done is you always hear these stories about people when they die. And so I went to the hospitals around the city, and there's about six major hospitals here. And I went not to the doctors or the nurses. I went to the chaplains, who are the people who are there when the people actually die. And what I wanted to know was the weird stuff, like, does anybody ever have a dead relative come just when they're ready to die to take them over? Does anybody ever predict their own death? Does anybody ever have a near-death experience? You got to remember, this is in the mid-70s when near-death experiences, the first book comes out. So it really wasn't that well known then. And basically, they confirmed all this weird stuff did happen at death. Like I said, is there ever a miracle? And they said, well, yeah, there's miracles. People get up at the last second, and when they're minutes away from dying, and they walk out, they always come back. And they're always something that sort of motivates them to sort of get well for a couple of weeks or a month or a year or whatever, and then they come back. So that was what I was doing. And I remember being at university, and I was taking science, and I was taking calculus, and I couldn't figure out, what am I going to do with this nonsense? Like, this is just total. I mean, what was a function? Where did the numbers go? I was so demoralized with university. I couldn't figure out, like, why people wanted to take this kind of stuff. And I was doing fairly well. I mean, I wasn't a stupid kid. But what happened was, and this is February of 1975. This is just as the Vietnam War is ending. The Vietnam War ends in April, and I think it's tied in. I'm there, and then these UFO sightings start in at a town called Carmen, which is about maybe 30 miles north of the border. And it's on the news. It's a big story. I live in a major city, 700,000 people, but this is about 35 miles outside the city towards the border. And really didn't have interest, but I saw these stories on the newspaper and TV and stuff like that. And I said to my friend, I said, you know, we drive around the city. We don't really do anything. Instead of driving around the city and doing nothing, why don't we go out and see what everybody's looking at? And he said, okay, we'll do that. And we never did do it. And what happened was, in May of 1975, 3 months later, the local TV crew here actually caught this thing jumping off the ground. 30 years later, I actually think that this thing was all planned to get me out, because I would never have gone out. If it hadn't been caught on the ground, jumping off the ground by this TV crew. And then it was big news in the city. And I said to my friend, come on, let's go see what they're looking at. And the way I always describe it is, it's like you buy the Powerball ticket, and you know there's a chance you can win, but you know you're not going to win. And I said, okay, we're going to go out there. Everybody else, because it was people where there was people from the city. There was piles of people out there. When the second night I was out there, there was 27 people on this side road in the middle of nowhere, just like people gathering in big piles all over the place. And everybody wanted to see this thing because it kept flying around there. So we went out and we drove in the town, out of the town, in the town, out of the town. And this went on for an hour. And we're looking at, trying to see, what is everybody looking at? And we're looking up at stars and planets. And I have no interest in any of this kind of stuff. And I don't know what. And we're going, wow, whatever they're looking at, it's not very impressive. And my friend says, we'll drive back in town one more time. We don't see anything. We're going home. I said, fine with me. This is about midnight. Fine with me. This is a total waste of time. And as we turned around to go back in this town, we're about a mile out of the town, we turn and it appeared from the left to the right. It was down low, it was about a couple hundred feet off the ground. It was not a light in the sky, it was an object. And I always describe to people, when it comes to paranormal phenomena or something, there's knowing and believing. If you have not seen anything, you can either believe or disbelieve, but it is only when you see it that you know. And nobody in the car said, is that what they're looking at? I wonder if that's what they're looking at. And just everybody went, there it is. Everybody just suddenly knew. And it was like pandemonium in the car, yelling and screaming as this thing came right in front of the car. It flew right across the road in front of the car. And I remember it was going behind these set of school buses that were being stored outside the town. And so I was getting out of the car. The car was still moving. And I was getting out of the car because I wanted to run through the ditch and across this parking lot because I knew it was going to get in behind these school buses and I wouldn't be able to see it anymore. And I got there and I just watched this thing just sort of, it looked like it was alive. It was like it was red. It was pulsing. It was like a plasma object. So you couldn't see what the actual object was, but it was this bright, brilliant, pulsing red object. And it just slowly flew off into the northeast. And I went, wow. And I went back to the city and I told all my friends, I said, man, this will change your life. You can't believe, you got to come and see this. And I talked a bunch of my friends to come out there. Two nights later, we went out there and we were on the other side of the town. We were trying to find an airport. There was a small airport there. And the guy who ran the airport was sort of the tour guide. He knew where this thing was coming and he was taking the TV crews out and stuff like that. So we couldn't find this airport because all the lights were turned off. We happened to be standing right beside it, but I had all my friends there. And again, the same thing. We're sitting there waiting and nothing's happening. And I can still remember my friends as they left said, oh, Cameron, this is garbage. I mean, we're going home. And I said, no, you got to stay. You got to see this. You will not believe what you see. And they said, no, we're hungry. We're going back to Winnipeg for pizza. And that was it. They all just took off. And there was 28 people there. And when it was finally came, there was our car, which had about four people, one, two, three, four people. And then there was a car beside us. And the car beside us, there was a courier car, and there was a girl. I remember when this happened, there was a girl in the car, and there was three guys. And this guy had, this is in the time when they had motor drives on Nikon cameras, when they first came in. And I can remember he had this big telephoto lens on it, and they were sitting there waiting. We were waiting, and this flash, and it was different. It was a flash in the sky, like a flash cube, and it was jumping around the sky. And as it got closer, the flash got closer together, and then this object that I saw the first night appeared. This time it was coming right at us. And it's like people yelling and screaming, and this girl could not see it because it was jumping around the sky. She's crying. People are yelling and screaming. They're swearing, and this thing was coming in, and she's saying, I can't see it. I can't see it. Someone show me. And I could hear this Nikon camera with this motor drive going, click, zzz, click, zzz, click. Click, and he was just unloading the camera as this thing was coming towards us. And then the same thing, it just sort of easily moved to the northeast and just sort of flew off. They got in the car and they took off, and the gravel was flying, and they went to chase this thing. And it would actually go so slow you could actually catch up on this thing. And it was at that point when I said, well, why is nobody recording this? This is like the biggest story of all times. So I went and I went to most of the people in the town, and one person would say, the first thing he would say is, how do you know I saw something? And I'd say, well, so-and-so said you saw something. And then they would sort of tell you the story, and then they'd say, well, yeah, I was the only one that saw it, you know? And they'd give you five names. And at one point, I had like 300 people on a list I hadn't even interviewed yet, because everybody kept squealing on everybody. And I gathered all this material together, and I tried to get it published. And nobody would publish the book. It's actually going to be published this July in Canada, but nobody would publish the book. And this is 1977 when I'm publishing this book. Mm-hmm. And I remember the local publisher said to me, Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff, count me among the unbelievers. And that basically was a big rejection letter, but it actually changed my life because I said, well, this sighting stuff's a waste of time. And from that point on, this sort of changed everything. From that point on, I wasn't interested in sightings. I couldn't care less what I'd seen. And I saw some stuff pretty close. At one point, I was ready to jump on this thing. I saw some pretty clear stuff in 75. But I know that I can tell you the story and you'll listen to it. And it'll be, people are interested in the sighting stuff. But it wasn't what I wanted. All I wanted was, who knows what I saw? There has to be someone in this world who knows what I saw that first night when it flew in front of the car. And I started this chase. I went to the Canadian government, and because I was told by somebody who actually worked for the Canadian government, they said, well, if you really want to know what's going on, you should study what Wilbur Smith was doing in the 1950s with the Canadian government. And I went and checked that all out. And he was actually talking to aliens. He was a contactee. He was talking to the Americans. And I got that story. And it sort of, a few more people believed what I was saying. And then I went after Dr. Eric Walker at Penn State University, who indicated that he knew what was going on. And he led me to the presidents. And so I spent 30 years looking for the files from the president. Because I said, well, the president's the most powerful guy in the world. He's got to know what's going on. He's got to know what I saw. And I spent all that time chasing the president around. And I got the Rockefeller Initiative documents from the Clintons. And I gathered all the stories of all the various presidents and who had seen stuff and what they saw and where the documents were. And I went to all the presidential libraries. And then, again, the big thing, the event that happened was February the 26th, 2012. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm watching a lecture by Colin Andrews, and Colin is lecturing on consciousness and crop circles. And he's talking about how 20% of crop circles are legitimate crop circles, 80% are hoaxed. The aliens are causing 20%, and the aliens are also causing the 80% that are hoaxed. They're telling the hoaxer people what to put down. And I'm listening to this, but I'm not interested in UFOs. I'm not interested in crop circles. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I went in the lecture was because he was a top researcher in the world. He was the top authority in the world on crop circles. And I figured, well, I should pay him the respect and go and see his lecture. And what happened was, and you will know about this, is I went into basically like an altered state. I just didn't want to be there. I was thinking about something else. So I wasn't really paying attention to him. And it happened instantaneously. Three pieces of evidence that I'd gathered over the 37 years at that point of my career all suddenly instantly popped into my head. And it was like they took the three pieces of the puzzle, they put them in my head, and then they said, this is how it works. And it came, and I keep describing this to people, and I don't think people understand. It's like a UFO sighting. Unless it happens to you, it's hard to understand. It came with absolute certainty. It was like, this is how it works. And I went, whoa! And for 2 days, I was just sort of wandering around in a daze that the answer I had been given was that this whole UFO phenomena, the answer that you've been looking for since 1975, is that it has to do with non-local consciousness. And it gave me three pieces of the puzzle. One was a document that I'd quoted for years, and I'd always quoted this, the Canadian government document from 1950, top secret document, where it said that the Canadians were told by American officials that other things might be associated with the phenomena such as with the flying saucers, such as mental phenomena. Mm-hmm. And in 1950, there was nobody talking to aliens. There was no contactees. There was no abductees. There was nobody saying, oh, I'm talking to aliens. All there was a bunch of UFOs flying around. Nobody was talking to them. Nobody made any claims. And so how did the Americans know to tell the Canadians that mental phenomena was involved in this whole thing? That popped into my head. The second thing that popped into my head was a conversation we had with this Dr. Eric Walker at Penn State University, the big engineering college. He had 14 earned doctorate degrees. He was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, the top military think tank in the country. And he's being asked by a researcher, a bunch of researchers I was sort of coordinating who were trying to get him to talk. And one researcher from Great Britain said to him, Dr. Walker, is there just still 12 people controlling this subject? Or is this international? Is this more than 12 and is an international group? And he said, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And I did not understand until Phoenix in 2012 what he was talking about. He just said, well, you understand about ESP? And the guy didn't really have an answer. So Walker answered the question for him. He said, look, unless you understand about ESP and how it works, you will not be taken in by the control group. Very few people understand how it works. I had no idea what he meant. And Phoenix 2012 said, and I went, oh, I know what he's talking about, because they put these pieces together. And the third thing was 1993, 2 years after Dr. Eric Walker told us this thing on a phone call at Penn State, Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works at Area 51, rumored to be back engineering the flying saucers, giving a lecture at UCLA to the engineering alumni. And it was during that lecture, at the end, he said, "We now have the technology to take ET home." And Jan Hartson, who was the international director of MUFON, who had had a close encounter in his backyard with a flying saucer with his brother at 9 years old, had become fascinated, just same as me, had become infatuated with flying saucers, wanted to become an electrical engineer to build a flying saucer, realized that this is chance. And as Ben Rich leaves the building, he says, I've got to ask him. He goes running up to Ben Rich. He said, "Ben, I've been fascinated with this subject my whole life. I need to know, Ben, how do they get here? How does the propulsion system works?" And Ben turns around and said exactly what Dr. Eric Walker had said 2 years before. He said, "Let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP?" Mm-hmm. And Jan went, he didn't expect a question. He went, "It means everything in time and space is connected." And Ben said, "That's how it works." Walks out of the room and walks away. So that was what changed me. And I the download experience was so overwhelming with its certainty that I suddenly understood that consciousness was the basis of, well, now I understand it's the basis of the universe. Forget about just UFOs, but it's the basis of everything. And I started to do, this is what I'm going to talk about at Ozark. Because I was so blown away by this download experience, I started to research. I said, well, if I have had a download experience, somebody else has to have had these kind of experiences. And that's when I started a Google search. And the first one I came across was music. Paul McCartney, with the song Yesterday, one of the most produced songs of the 20th century. He says, he wakes up in the middle of the night and this song's in his head. And he puts it down and he starts playing this song for people and say, "Have you ever heard this song before?" And everybody goes, "No, I never heard that song before." And he suddenly realized that this had come to him in a dream. And I started to realize that a lot of musicians get songs in dreams. Mm-hmm. A lot of musicians get songs that come in 5 minutes. And I started going through this whole thing and suddenly I had all these various ways that people get these downloads, and you do hypnosis, so you know that you can get this through hypnosis. It's done. Savants have this ability. Musicians have a lot of these. People have. They all have tape recorders. They all have pads beside their bed. John Lennon had a pad beside his bed because they know you have these moments of inspiration when you sort of. The way I explain it is you break the filter. You remove yourself from your ego left brain and get that out of the way. And once you can get the ego out of the way, whether it's psychedelics or hypnosis or drumming or chanting or fasting, and there's probably 30 different ways you can do this, then you can sort of rip that filter and get into this Akashic field, non-local field, whatever you want to call it, where everything actually exists. So that's what I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to apply it to the field of ufology that a lot of people don't really realize that the aliens or whoever this force is behind the UFO phenomena is actually allowing the experiencers to enter this field. For example, there's a group called FREE, Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Experiences, started by Edgar Mitchell. They polled 3,000 people who believe that they've had interaction with the beings. 42% of all those people say that they've got mathematical, scientific, or technical material in their head that they did not learn from school, that they got a download from somewhere. And the other one, which is even more dramatic, and this would go into what you do in terms of hypnosis, mm-hmm. 40% of all experiencers will state that at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. And to me, it's like, you did ask them, well, how do you know that you didn't know there was something on the far side of the universe that where they didn't tell you about this little thing? And they will all say what I say about my download experience. I really don't know, but I just know that I knew everything at one point in the universe. And that's, they're being linked into this non-local field where all the answers are. And so to me, this is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just connected in. It's just.
Yeah, you're tapping into this field that everything is actually there. And musicians will actually say this. Michael Jackson actually said when he was asked about doing Thriller, which sold 64 million albums, the top selling album of all times. And he was asked about this, where'd the inspiration, how did it work? And he said, you know, I think I'm talking to God. He said, I'm actually embarrassed to put my name on some of these songs because I'm just the scribe. The song was already there. I just transcribed it into this world. And this is Michael Jackson talking. And you go through musicians, you'll find that some of the top musicians of all times will say exactly the same thing, that these songs came to them, that there was no perspiration whatsoever. It was all inspiration. It was sort of like You Got a Friend by Carole King. And at one point in the 1970s, she was the top selling woman of all times, 25 million albums. She was on the chart for 6 years with this song, You Got a Friend. And she said the same thing. She said, I was sitting at the piano and she said, and suddenly it was like, it was coming. And she said, I didn't have any paper and I didn't have a tape recorder. Usually musicians have tape recorders to try to record when these events happen. She said, and I said, oh my God, I hope I remember this. I hope I remember this. And it was coming the same as J.K. Rowling. So when you get into books, J.K. Yeah. Rowling, who did all 7 books of Harry Potter, you can just go to the and I'll play at Ozark. I'll play a piece of her interview with Oprah, where Oprah asked her, because everybody knows the story, did you actually get this on a train going into London? She said, yeah, I was on a delayed train going into London. She had fallen asleep. I was having a nap. She woke up, and as she woke up, all 7 books of the Harry Potter series all downloaded into her head at one time. And she said, and I didn't have a pen, and this stuff was coming, and these names and locations, and this stuff was flooding into my head. And she said, I was so excited. I couldn't believe it. I just, wow, I'd love to do this. And even the last line of the book apparently came in this download. Same as The Wizard of Oz. He's reading the story to his 4 kids. And he said, suddenly the story of The Wizard of Oz starts downloading into his head. And he said, I had no paper. And he tells a story, and this is in the 1900, he tells a story that he's got envelopes, and he's finding envelopes, and he's writing on the back of envelopes as this story downloads into his head. And so this is what it is. It's, we live in this physical world where we have this filter that blocks that part of consciousness out in order to allow us to live in this physical world. But where all these different techniques, if you can rip that filter, if you can get out of that ego mind, left brain, you can access this kind of material, and you can access higher self, whatever you want to call it, and you can get the answer to everything that you want to know about how the world works.
Absolutely. We always call it just get out of your way. Get out of your own way, and you can you get direct access. Yeah, and get to everything. I know when I had one that I'm conscious of anyway, some downloads happening, I would get all these symbols coming in because I said I wanted to be aware when I was being downloaded. And so that would happen during the middle of the night. Wow. I would all of a sudden just wake up out of a sound sleep, and I would see all these symbols just coming in to my mind. And it would just be, at first they were just kind of just coming in, and then later they started taking on dimensional shapes and moving around and doing all kinds of things and stuff. And I was like, well, why am I awake? And they said, well, you asked to be aware, didn't you? And I was like, oh yeah. Oh God.
So, wow. Well, that's interesting. Maybe I will play I will show you some photos of symbols. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the Ariel School. This is 1994 in Zimbabwe. And the 62 school kids. Mm-hmm. And there's a documentary being done. One of the kids there, her name is Emily Trim. She's actually from Canada. She's from Hamilton. And she tells a story that she and another girl are walking along the edge of this playground on these logs that are sort of the borderline of the schoolyard. And they're running along these logs. She says she sees a flash of light, and then she sees they're going, and all of a sudden they look to their side, and there's an alien who's actually sort of hopping along with them on the logs, except it's levitated above the ground and it's sort of imitating them hopping on these logs. And she said she realized that. And then she said, suddenly this alien is in front of them, and they start getting the downloads, and she's getting technological downloads. And it's this flashing, flash, these images flashing into her head at very rapid speed. And the girl beside her is getting she's getting ecological, the destruction of the world. You'll hear these stories. She's getting these downloads of pictures of the destruction of the world. So they record, and she's 8 years old when this happens. Mm-hmm. And then she has an event 3 years ago in Hamilton, and she describes they appear to her in her kitchen. And she hasn't really gotten into too much. I've heard part of the story, but she's actually very religious. And she got on her knees and she said she started sort of praying to them, and they were there. And she started getting these downloads of symbols. So she has, since this is 3 years, she started to paint, and she's painted 100 paintings, and they're unbelievable paintings. They're like, she'd never painted before, and she just suddenly got this. A lot of people will get these things where they can suddenly paint, and she's mm-hmm. painting. And in these paintings, there's all these symbols. And she said the symbols are the important part. So I'll show maybe about five of, when I'm in Ozark, I'll put five of her paintings there, which is very fascinating. She said that's the key part of the thing. But so people have asked me to go and start looking at these symbols, because a lot of experiencers will actually see symbols in, it's almost like a universal language, or they'll do something that doesn't really appear anymore, or never appeared before when I first started. Cause I've been in this, I've been in this since before Jesus was a carpenter, and and only in the last 10 years have I heard these stories that you would have been laughed out if you tried to tell these stories in the 1970s. And these are people that are speaking light languages, where they can suddenly, they're speaking these light languages. Well, that never happened before 10 years ago. I was like, and I'll have a meeting. I had a group here, and I have a group, and suddenly I realized there's three people in my group who are speaking this light language. I'm going, are you kidding me? It's just like, and so you have these symbols and you have the light language, and it all ties together as if we're being almost led by breadcrumbs, that we're being moved down this path, and we're being given stuff as we advance. We're being given more material. And then you have the idea that you, I, a bunch of people, even the whole idea about the three waves, that we have volunteered for these positions. We've come in here. And so when people ask me, you know, what's the meaning of life? What's it all about? I say, very simple. You came here, you plan to do something. If it's a multiple life universe, if there's only one life, well, then everything's different. But if it's reincarnation, it's multiple lives, you plan to do something when you got here. And you at some point are going to leave this world. Your only problem in this life is to figure out, what did I plan to do when I got here, and am I doing it? Simple. That's what life's all about. Trying to figure out what you agreed to do when you got here. So I believe that a lot of these things are not really random, and that all these things are planned. So if a person is an abductee, they aren't really an abductee. They weren't abducted. They volunteered for that. They have volunteered to be in that position. And even in Free, I know there was a big sort of discussion, where 35% of all experiencers who claim to have been on board the ship and abducted and this sort of stuff, all claim to have had near-death experiences. And they were going to set up a committee. And they said, well, we got to figure out, like, why are these people all having near-death experiences? And I said, you don't need a committee. It's very simple. If you understand how the world works, it's not random. It's not a random, meaningless universe. It is planned. So if you came into this world and you planned to be an abductee, and then you plan to have near-death experience to learn something else, well, this was planned. If I can predict that you are going to have a car accident tomorrow and be injured, is that a random event? No, it's, you got to get rid of the random idea that there's two random events. A lot of this stuff is not random events. These are things that we have planned to learn from, to teach other people, to do this play. And that's what it all comes down to. So when I had this download about the consciousness thing, that's when suddenly it was like, I describe it. It was like suddenly I had glasses on. I could read the street signs, and suddenly everything started to make sense. And before then, I'd spent 37 years chasing the president, chasing the head scientist for the CIA, collecting documents, getting into all this conspiracy stuff. And there was never any answers. It was sort of like you're spinning your wheels. As soon as you get this idea of how the world works and this consciousness thing, and you start seeing what's going on, then it all starts to make sense. And so that's where I tie in Ozark, I'll tie in all the download stuff, the consciousness stuff, where I got this download thing, and how you, different types of downloads, whether it's musicians or savants or artists or stuff like that, and then how it fits into the UFO world, and you see the same thing going on. It's almost like, you know, the same stuff, it's just a different day. It's all, people will want to parse, like, oh, there's channelers, and I'm not a channeler, I'm an experiencer, and then there's psychic phenomena, and then no, it's all the same thing. It's just a different variation, and we parse it and try to separate it. But it's all one, like God's a verb, the universe is a verb, it's all the same thing. And you just have to figure out how this all fits together. And it does fit together very, very, very nicely, I think.
It does, and that's so beautiful, and I'm so glad you're doing that, Grant. I'm so glad you had this that we call it an awakening. This that happened, because that's what Mom and I were trying to do so long. It was like we had all this whole UFO world over here, and then you had the spiritual world over here, and it was like, can't they see it's all the same?
It's all the same thing. It's all, yeah. I've been calling it even more than an awakening. I said it was like almost like the J.K. Rowling thing. I woke up in 2012 and realized I was on the wrong train. I mean, I was not even going to the right place. I had to actually get off and go someplace else. And that's what happens is you see these things. And when these things happen, people have to realize that these are important events. It's almost like with the work that you and your mother are doing, or the work that Edgar Cayce used to do, or the other big event I had in my life that just blew me away was I saw Dr. Michael Newton speak at a conference. And it was another thing. It was like, I didn't want to go to the lecture. I had no interest in this kind of stuff. And he starts talking about this life between life thing, where you sit in this big amphitheater before you're born, and you see different events and stuff like that. And when something happens in your life, like you see a woman with a silver brooch, and it's suddenly like you realize something's happened, you've got to pick up these cues that these are things that are happening that you plan to happen. And if you sort of allow yourself to live your life that way, rather than resisting what's happening, everything you've placed all these things in front of you, it's to figure out the flow and to go with the flow. And so, I mean, the work that your mother did was very, very important, almost the same league as Michael Newton, and the same as Edgar Cayce. And you see these events all being put down. And when you put them together, there's three or four different fields of study, but they're all basically saying the same thing.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so wonderful that someone of your caliber is making the same connection and putting it all. Oh, it's so wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
although it still is being rejected. I mean, it's still the 90%, maybe not 90%, but it's a high percentage of the UFO community is still into this what I call the scientific, rational, analytical, measure it type thing, looking for lights in the sky, because we always see ourselves as the Rodney Dangerfield of the scientific world. It's like, you know, we don't get no respect from anybody. And so the way you get respect in this modern world, unfortunately, is that the scientists, not the government, not the media, it's the scientists that run this world. And they are the people that are held up as the priests of the 21st century. And in order to try to get accepted, you sort of go along with this thing, well, we got to measure it, we got to reproduce it and stuff like that. And no, this is consciousness type stuff. This is not something that when you come to, you know, quantum physics, there's a measurement problem. You start to understand how the world works. Material is not the basis of the universe. The basis of the universe is consciousness. That a particle does not appear in time and space until there's consciousness. And that's something that science has sort of rejected. And the UFO community is ignoring this. They're ignoring the experiencers. They're sort of ignoring the stuff I'm saying as well, because they still are linked into, they want this sort of acknowledgement by the scientific community. My difference was, I really don't care what people think. I know what I saw. I mean, I was absolutely floored by what I saw. And people can stand on their head, do whatever they want. They're not going to tell me that I saw anything. So I was over that right from the word go, by having these very, very dramatic experiences. And so I really didn't care what people thought. I just wanted to know what the answer was. And unfortunately, for a lot of researchers, the answer is not the important thing. It's to get respect. So you'll say things like, well, we really don't know what's going on. You know, it's a big mystery. And it's like, give your head a shake. Come on. We got to move on here. We got to get past that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think and maybe it's just our conference, because this is how we are and this is what we're drawing to us. Yeah. But what I'm seeing is that the researchers that are coming, more and more of them are shifting and are starting to say things. You're coming out more. You're coming out the most of what I've heard anybody say. But I am hearing others say, you know, at least they're kind of shifting over. And not being so hard and fast, you know, nuts and bolts and everything.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
So
in the last 30 years, I mean, it's completely different world. I mean, people have made this shift to consciousness. More and more people, even if they're just saying it, you know, the consciousness mm-hmm. is important and this understanding and stuff like that. And it's a growing process. It's almost like mm-hmm. we have an eternity to figure this thing out. It's not like we have to figure it out tomorrow that, you know, if you don't figure it out, you're a loser or stuff. It's a growing process as it was with me. As I said, I mean, I didn't intend to do any of this kind of stuff. If I hadn't been dragged out to Carmen mm-hmm. to see this thing, if I hadn't gone into that lecture, not even wanting to go into that lecture with Michael Newton or with Colin Andrews, none of this would happen for me either. I would have been the same as everybody else. So I feel fortunate in that I had these events happen to me that basically just, I mean, rock my world. And mm-hmm. so I try to just, it's my position. And I put it out, like I publish my stuff. I published quite a few books in the last year or whatever. And it's just basically to put it down. Mm-hmm. And that's why I tell experiencers and people who've had sightings, the first thing I always say is, have you written this down? And they say, well, no. And I say, well, you got to realize that 500 years from now, this is going to be like you people lived at the time of Jesus Christ, the signing of the Constitution. You should record your event, your experience, for your children and your grandchildren, because you are living. And I tell people, like especially experiencers, people who have actually sort of interacted with the beings, that are sort of sometimes they'll whine and complain about, you know, it's a tough life, whatever. And I always remind them, I said, you've got to realize you are playing in the Super Bowl of all stories. There is no bigger story in the world than what is breaking here. And you're not outside the arena. You're in the stadium. You may be the quarterback. You may be the water boy. You could have been born as an untouchable in the streets of Calcutta and spend your day in the junkyard looking for something valuable enough to sell for food for tomorrow. No, you didn't. You got to play in this unbelievable story about consciousness, about UFOs, about the reality and stuff like that. And you should realize you're in the Super Bowl and you should be writing down your story and recording, because you're very, very lucky to be in this game. And because you're inside the stadium, you probably have something you're supposed to be doing that you mm-hmm. came here to do. And then people will sit up. They'll actually, experiencers will actually sit up and realize, yeah, that this is actually an opportunity. It's not a disadvantage that, you know, we could have been in lives where lots of times you'll see if you go to a party or something where people aren't really into the field that we're in, and you listen to the conversations that they're having and you go like, wow, I could not go back to that world, you know, talking about people who aren't in the room and who's sleeping with who and exactly. You know, and what are these people doing, and it's like almost the idea that you know, there's three levels of thought. There's, you know, talking mm-hmm. about other people, talking about things, and talking about ideas. And at least in our world, we're in the world of talking about ideas. And people, when I used to lecture at Ozark years ago, and when I go to conferences, I'll come back and people think that we're at conferences and we're sitting there talking about flying saucers and showing pictures of flying saucers. And I say, it's never that. It's never. It's always like, you know, what's God? How does reality work? And the conversations will start with flying saucers, but they'll always end up in almost every conversation I've been with this, what is reality? What's really going on? And this
What's really going on?
So it's a different world than people think it is on the outside. And mm-hmm. and I sort of feel sorry for people who don't have this. And I still can't really understand, how can you not be interested in this stuff? Whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, your work or the idea of reincarnation, or trying to spend 5 minutes figuring out why you're here. Because most people, mm-hmm. what will happen is they'll just play around and make money and watch sports and stuff like that. And then someone will say, you got 6 months to live. And then I go, holy cow. You know, like, and then they're trying to figure out, like, why am I here? What's going on? I mean, how did this happen? How did I get picked to die? This is unfortunate, you know. And then they start trying to think about life. You and I and the people in these fields of study spend our whole life trying to figure out, why are we here? Where are we going? How does this all work? It's this the highest level of thought that I think you can do is to analyze these kind of things.
Right, and trying to help other people, you know, exactly. Try to see their paths along the way, you know, to help them as well. So
yeah. 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 And because it's an important message that we have for the world, and not to record it, even for your children. Because I think, I don't know, you're different with your mother, but I know with my son, I had a health scare. And so what happened with me was I had like 6 or 7 books that were like, you know, 80% done. And I said, oh, my goodness, I got to get this on paper, man. I just went crazy. I just had to do it because I realized that if I died, my son has no interest in this at all. None. He's had ghost type experiences. He's had a couple of UFO experiences, but he's not. He's basically into golfing, have a couple of beers. I got to make some money. I got to pay the bills and stuff like that. He's into that world. And I realized that if I died, all my stuff is on the computer. It's gone. It is gone forever. And so that's why I say to people, you got to put this story down because it may not seem important now, but when even I remember Angela Joyner, who spoke at Ozark one time, Angela Joyner did the Stevensville, Texas thing, and she actually lost her job over this thing. She had the big story and it went around the world and stuff like that. And she did the story. And then, of course, the story died off and then people kept phoning her with new sightings. And the newspaper told her, Angela, give this up. You've got the front page story to do. You've got the court report to do and stuff like that. And she said, well, what am I going to do with these people to keep phoning me with all these sightings? They said, ignore them. Oh. And then she told people, phone me at home at night. And then she got caught. She was talking to the Dallas Morning News and she got called into the office and they had her Rolodex and her a box of stuff. And they said, you know, this isn't working out or whatever. And she said, well, no, we just parted ways. I said, no, they fired you, Angela. In Canada, when they do that, that's called getting fired. And so she basically lost her job over this. And I said, you know, Angela, it may have been a bad thing for you, but I'll guarantee you 500 years from now, your great, great grandchildren will say that Angela Joyner, she was my great, great grandmother. And she stood up and she took a position and she spoke out for this thing. So even though it may look right now like a bad thing, she's got a place in history of covering this very, very important UFO sighting that took place in Stevensville, Texas about 10 years ago. And people got to realize that the message that we have, the story that we have, is an extremely important story for the world.
Well, and that's what I was going to say was on your website, I was looking at like the polls that you said are they've been taken with a lot of the experiencers. And so many of them say that there's this message, you know, that they've been given messages or things like that, that they have a mission or things of that kind. And if you want to share that, because that's how it all feels, you know, and that's definitely if you have a recollection of a sighting or anything at all, but that's how it feels. Would you want to share on that?
Yeah, that's an important part. When I talk to experiencers, and almost every one of them, I'll say to them, do you think you have a mission? And they'll sort of pause and they'll go, I think so, but I really don't know what it is. And this is the whole thing is that they've been drawn into this kind of thing. Even people who've had UFO sightings. Mm-hmm. And I tell this because John Lennon was one who had the UFO sighting. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he had a he was so close. He said he was short-sighted. So he said, I could see it very clearly without my glasses on. He was naked. And May Pang, who was his girlfriend at the time, who we've actually talked to about this, they were trying to take photographs of the thing. And it was there for quite a while. It was there for about 10 minutes. And it had these big marquee light bulbs around the bottom of this craft and had a red light on the top. And so I say to people, I say, you know, when you have a UFO, it has lights on it. Why does a UFO have lights on it? Why did John Lennon's UFO have these big marquee light bulbs around the bottom of the craft? Do they need big marquee light bulbs to fly through time and space? No, it's there. They have lights on UFOs so you can see it. We don't have lights on our planes. Only the reason we have lights on our planes is just for navigation purposes or safety purposes like on cars. But you don't need a light on a UFO. It's flying around. It has lights on it for different reasons, so you can see it. And all of them look the same, or all of them look different. So I say, if you see a UFO, you're part of the game. You saw that UFO for a reason. And right. So these people do have they believe they have these missions. A lot of them are seeing the screen. I think it's 39% of them are shown the screen on board the craft where they're showing these environmental destruction types things, or they're shown given messages about 54% of all experiencers are talked to about oneness and love. And if you go into the whole thing about reality, there is only one. There is no separation. It's all one. And there is only love. The fear is just the absence of love, the same as there is no darkness. Darkness is not a thing unto itself. Darkness is just the absence of light. The farther you get away from the light, the darker it appears. And so you get these concepts that people are getting. These 54% are being talked about oneness and love, these key principles that when you get into the work that your mother did or you're doing, it comes up the same thing. It comes up in ancient Eastern language, Eastern religions, and they got it through meditation. So they're tapping in, and we're being told these very important things. And when you look at the stats from the free survey, you see these, I mean, just sort of dramatic stats that you would never believe, like 83%. People say, oh, it's a horrible thing. You know, these evil aliens are here and they're abducting people and stuff. And so when you ask the question, if you had the chance to stop your experience, would you stop it? 83% of all experiencers say, no, let it go on. Don't stop it. And you'll have most people in the outside world will think, oh, abduction, there's these evil aliens, they're abducting people against their will and all this kind of stuff. And yet when you ask the experiencers how many think it's evil, it's 9%. And what I say is, it's not zero, but it's getting pretty close. I mean, I would say the 9% that are saying it's evil are people who have just woken up. They've just realized that this is going on. And what you'll find with experiencers is the more you regress them, the more you talk to them, the more they go through it, the less evil the phenomena becomes. And suddenly, the one prime one, there's actually a big announcement going to be made. There's a friend of mine, Chris Bledsoe, who's an experiencer out of North Carolina, who he was so devastated by his experience. He's a big businessman in North Carolina. It's 2007. He actually wanted God to take him away. He said, I can't handle this. I mean, his world fell apart. He was a Pentecostal deacon. They threw him out of the church, and he lived in, you know, all the Southern Baptists and Pentecostals. He was ostracized. Nobody would talk to him. And he was hiding in his house and stuff like that. And suddenly when he got regressed one time, and then he had two experiences with what he calls the shining lady, who said, Chris, you have a burden, and it is yours to carry. And the first time he has this experience with the shining lady, who tells him, you got a message for the world, is exactly the same day I had my downhill experience in Phoenix. Exactly the same day. You talk to Chris Bledsoe now. He's in Hollywood. They're going to be making big time his story, big time. Chris Bledsoe is out to save the world. He was in this hiding in his house, you know, wanting to die, wanting this to end. And once he realized that he had this message for the world, I mean, he's like he's out to save the world. You cannot shut the guy up. And his message will get out there. Actually, Warner Brothers at one point, Mel Gibson from Warner Brothers, they were going to throw $80 million at his story. Julia Roberts was going to play one of the roles in this movie. And it was a huge Hollywood type thing that they were going to run this guy's story. So he goes from this, the phenomena being a very evil phenomena, to what I think happens with all the experiences, that the more you deal with it, the less evil it becomes, and the more it fits into this idea that you are a very important person, you are in the Super Bowl, and you have something to do to help the world.
Well, that's like, and I noticed, and thank you for mentioning her book, Sherry Wilde's book. It's one of our authors, The Forgotten Promise. And another author that we have coming out this year is a very similar story, and her book is called From Fear to Love. And that's where they go through that process, because in the beginning it's fear. And that's where I think some of that is coming from, where they think it's something horrible and it's fear. It's where that's shrouding all of that. But then as they are processing it and as they keep going through it, then they start realizing what's actually going on, and they start seeing the love. And that's what it all comes back to, is what it all comes down to in the end is, oh my gosh. And then it all comes down to the same message.
Yeah. It's that Sherry Wilde. I promoted her book big time. I had her in my group and brought a bunch of her books in to sell. And I sort of refer, I was actually going to do a book, and I've got so many other things going. I was going to do a book called The 10 Prophets, and she would be one of the 10 prophets. It's almost like, all these UFO stories, like, which story should you listen to? And I always say Sherry Wild, and yeah. I say the Sue Hansen. She's another one I say from New Zealand, that these are people who have total recall. And when you listen, I mean, Sherry Wild's thing, I mean, the three lessons. What are the three lessons, Sherry? Repeat them from the time she's like 5 years old. What are the three lessons?
Yeah.
Oneness. Number one is the oneness lesson. And that mm-hmm. if anybody learns nothing from ufology, the number one lesson of the beings that are behind this phenomena is oneness. It is the number one message of everything. And so Sherry Wild, I just fascinated with her story. I've heard her lecture numerous times, and I'm glad you published her book, because in people, if they haven't read it, I tell people that's one of the 10 prophets. That's one of the people. If you, all these UFO people that you've heard, this is one of the people you should read this story. It will tell you an awful lot of what's going on.
Absolutely. We had her again at the conference last year, and it was so wonderful because she was like, she kept going back and forth. Should I come? Should I not? Should I come? And finally she said, okay. She said, your mother came to me and she said, yes, you must go. You must go. so she went, and she was so nervous. She was just being pulled back and forth about whether to do it or not, because she was nervous about what she was going to say. She says, I'm just going to tell it. I'm going to tell it all. I'm going to tell it all. I said, tell everything, you know, say what you're supposed to say.
Yeah.
And she did. And I want you to know, she got a standing ovation.
Oh yeah. Fantastic. I mean, in fact, that's when I sort of learned about her, is she does that interview at Ozark out on the balcony there. And I recognized the balcony. And so I watched the interview, and that's when I sort of came familiar with her. And people don't realize, I mean, her daughters filed a lawsuit to stop her from publishing that book. I mean, this is not some story where, you know, she's out to make a buck. I mean, she's gone back and forth on this thing and been very traumatized by these events. And it's almost the same sort of thing. It's like, when you let go and let it go, then it happens. But she's like I was. It's sort of, you're fighting it. And you got to realize that you've agreed to this kind of stuff, that it will all work out as long as you just let it flow. And fascinating lady and fascinating story, that everybody should know that story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when she tells, I mean, yeah, it's what, you know, she's coming from truth. She's coming from her heart. And
And then in the end, now she's got the movie deal. So she's like Chris Bledsoe, where eventually this will all work out. And now her one daughter's talking to her again, and it wasn't the end of the world for the daughters. And it will be a famous story that she did record. And in fact, it's one of the download stories that I have in the book. And the book was inspired, The Paranormal World of Creativity. In that book, because I went to her and I said, was it a download? She said, yeah. She said, she's sitting in front of the typewriter or in front of the computer, and she'd never used a word processing program. She would do YouTube and stuff like that. And she suddenly looked at the screen and she saw this writing, and she started to read it and realized it was her story. And she went, oh no, I'm not doing that. Oh no, I'm not. And then she scrolled back, and she'd written three pages already. She scrolled back and went, well, that's not so bad. But that's how it worked. Like they forced, and I said, did they force you to, for the movie? And she said, yeah. And she said she was driving in the car, and she said all of a sudden she sees this 3D thing going on in front of her face, like a movie. And she said, what are you doing? It's dangerous. What are you doing? And they said, this is the opening scene to your movie. So it's like they're dragging her down this path. And she's gone from this, almost like Chris Bledsoe, from this very, very dark suicidal type thing to, you know, movie contracts and everybody, people like me saying, this is the most important, one of the most important stories you could possibly read, that you should read this story. And very important that she may not have written it if it hadn't been for them forcing her to sit in front of this word processor and do the first couple pages for her. And she basically said that she just typed and it came into her head. And that's almost like the Paul McCartney from, you know, the yesterday, where yesterday, it just appears in your head and you link into that, or they can help you link into that. You go into this field, you download it, higher self, wherever this is coming from, and everybody can do it. That's the most important part. You've got a technique to do it. There's all sorts of other techniques that I go through in the book that have been used to enter into this world where you can get this kind of stuff. We're starting to understand now actually how to do it, how to access your higher self, how to access these answers. And this will help the world when people realize this is just not some sort of accidental thing that happens. This is something that everybody can do.
Exactly. Well, real quick, before we run out of time, Grant, can you give people how they can find you if they want to, if they want to contact you or anything? Do you have ways?
Yeah, my website is presidentialufo.com. And my email address for people who have questions is whitehouseufo@gmail.com. And then I have a site that I always promote. I have a Facebook site called Paranormal World of Creativity. It's a Facebook site. And what I do on that site, on that Facebook, is all I do is post the latest song that came in a dream, the latest inspiration, the latest invention that came through some sort of download experience. And I put all these, and it's just, there's hundreds of them there. And you can just go through these lists and see unbelievable downloads and inspirations that people got all through the centuries. Because and anybody who has one, I would encourage them to send to me at whitehouseufo@gmail, because I do collect these things. I'm fascinated with these things, and there's a lot of them that I haven't got yet.
Well, I cannot wait to hear your talk and to meet you and everything at the conference. So you have been fascinating here.
Well,
you are just a treasure. So thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. And I'm honored to be interviewed by you. I've followed your work and your mother's work and promoted it. And I just fascinated and thankful that you're interested in what I'm doing.
Oh, absolutely. Before we go, do you have any last message for everyone just to send them off?
No, I just hope everybody's going to be at Ozark. I lectured there for many years. I always tell people, this is one of the, I've lectured at almost every big conference in Canada, the United States, and Europe and stuff. And this is one of the big ones, especially the Wizards Behind the Curtain. This is one of the bigger conferences. It's not that well known, but I say it's a very cheap conference. It's all in one thing. And to see Eureka Springs, Arkansas, people tell people, just go for the town. I mean, this town that everything looks like is 100 years old. I tell people, and I've actually bring in my editor from Los Angeles is coming. I have a girl here from Winnipeg who's coming with me, and I'm promoting the conference big time, because I tell people, you have not lived until you've been to the Ozark UFO conference. I don't know if you still do the bar, but the Lone Star Bar used to be in the parking lot, and I said, you can't believe it. There's like 100 people standing in the parking lot at 1 o'clock in the morning, Linda Howe and all of us, and people are just talking. I said, there's no conference where you get this kind of interaction type thing. So fantastic stuff. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it. And I hope everybody shows up at Eureka Springs in April.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And they're calling time on us. So
there you go.
Yeah. So we'll see everyone there, and I'll see you there, Grant. And thank you again.
Bet.
Thank you
thank
so
you,
much.
Julia. Beautiful.
You're welcome. And I'll see you all next time. And we love you all. And good night, everyone.